cannot slap China in the face like this and expect them to simply surrender. They didn't.
And he says that could lead to some problems when Trump and Xi meet in Argentina. This is Thursday, November 22nd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, the U.S. maintains a hard line on South Korea's dealings with Pyongyang. Thousands of schools in Pakistan aren't schools at all. And you'll hear one of the many stories of Thanksgiving this day in the United States. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Sharp exchanges between U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and Chinese leader Xi Jinping at this year's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, APEC, meetings, and the regional body's failure to issue a joint statement that was not just a sign of the deep divide between Washington and Beijing on trade, according to analysts. Although Beijing denies that it caused the breakdown at the APEC meetings in Papua New Guinea, directing blame at what it says was the anger Mike Pence brought to the meeting, others argue it was China's unwillingness to sign the joint statement that caused it to fail. What will APEC's inability or unwillingness to reach an accord mean to the upcoming G20 meeting in Buenos Aires, a meeting that is expected to see some direct communication on the sidelines between U.S. President Trump and Chinese leader Xi? Joining us is Phil Levy, senior fellow on the global economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and former senior economist for trade for President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. So what went wrong with APEC?
It did not seem like a diplomatic success, and it also did not seem like it was setting the stage for any quick resolution of the conflict between the United States and China. If anything, Vice President Pence, who had a long career as a free trader, has seemed to be the voice of entrenched opposition to China.
Why do you think that is? Was that set up that way, that he went instead of Trump? Is there an intentional move, as far as you are concerned, about taking a very strong sense against China? And how is China reacting to that?
Presidents like to show up when they think there's going to be some, you know, glory to be reaped from this. And that clearly was not the case with APEC, that this was going to be conflict and, you know, being chastised by someone. And if you're president, that's when you think, I'll send the vice president in my stead. I think what we're seeing here is, particularly in the approach that Vice President Pence has taken, you're not only getting the litany of economic complaints about China, but they're also getting tinged with serious national security concerns. The important point about that is it's going to make it very hard for this administration to reverse course with any speed.
Is that not the case for China, as their very strong sense by Xi Jinping? Is it not almost the same situation?
Well, I think one of the ways to interpret China's reaction to all this was those who had hypothesized that China would be vulnerable, that China's economy was shaky, that China was going to be desperate to have a quick resolution, were probably disabused of that notion, that you cannot slap China in the face like this and expect them to simply surrender. They didn't. They took a strong stand. They tried to claim the high ground as the defender of the multilateral trading system. There's a fair bit of irony in that. But rhetorically, it puts them in a somewhat stronger position given the attacks on the system that the Trump administration has put forward.
Now, we move on to the next coming weeks when the meeting between Trump and Xi is at least scheduled on the sidelines in Buenos Aires. How do you think this prelude to that meeting will affect that meeting?
I certainly don't think the results of APEC bode well. Ideally, if you are going to have a successful summit between heads of state, you have months at least of background work by lower level officials that would not usually be at the vice presidential level, but lower still, who are working out all the details, teeing everything up, and leaving a few key issues to be resolved. As far as I know, there are some meetings that are starting to happen, but we haven't seen the kind of preparatory work that usually will lead to a successful summit, even if we were talking about relatively mundane issues. And the kind of things on the agenda between the U.S. and China are not mundane, nor are they easy.
So what kind of pitfalls does that raise?
It means that you could have a repeat of the G20 of the kind of conflict that we saw at APEC, where it's not open hostility, of course, but it's kind of chilly.
So what happens now? What happens if your assessment and your prediction of the possibility of the meeting in Buenos Aires to end up like APEC, where does it leave the situation?
Well, this would be China sort of calling President Trump's bluff, perhaps, that the president has kind of hinted to farmers and others who are suffering from Chinese retaliation that a deal is around the corner, the end is in sight, don't worry, hang on, you'll sell those crops after all. If you don't have a deal, I don't think soybean crops can sit forever in the fields or in the silos. And meanwhile, the president has committed $200 billion of imports from China from 10% to 25% as of January 1st, and that's coming up soon.
Phil Levy, Senior Fellow on the Global Economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, joining us via Skype. Thank you, Phil. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at voanews.com. Interpol's General Assembly voted Wednesday to make South Korea's Kim Jong-un its new president. Kim has been serving as the organization's acting president and will serve the final 2 years of the term of the man he replaced, China's Meng Hongwei, who disappeared while visiting his native country in late September. In the span of 2 months from October to November, Indonesia's national police have arrested more than a dozen civilians who spread false information on social media, particularly on Facebook. Researchers said Wednesday they found a second patient in Hong Kong who contracted a strain of hepatitis carried by rats in what appears to be the first known human cases in the world. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Tuesday said South Korean efforts at rapprochement with North Korea must be in tandem with progress by Pyongyang toward denuclearization so as not to undermine the pressure campaign to get Pyongyang to give up its nuclear program.
I think there's complete agreement between the South Koreans and us with respect to how this should proceed. We now have a working group that formalizes those processes so that we can be sure that we don't talk past each other, that we don't take an action or the South Koreans don't take an action that the other is unaware of or hasn't had a chance to comment on or provide their thoughts. And that's the purpose of the working group that's being led on our side by Stephen Biegun. We have made clear to the Republic of Korea that we do want to make sure that that peace on the peninsula and the denuclearization of North Korea aren't lagging behind the increase in the amount of interrelationship between the two Koreas. We view them as tandem, as moving forward together. We view them as important parallel processes, and that working group is designed to make sure they continue to remain that way.
Well, that so-called working group met in Washington Tuesday. Little progress toward denuclearization has been seen since the historic summit in Singapore in June between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. James Kim, a research fellow at the Seoul-based Asian Policy for Asian Institute for Policy Studies, told VOA's Victor Beatty, Pompeo's statement is no surprise. It is the position Washington has held since day one.
That North Korea needs to make meaningful concessions on the nuclear front before any other corresponding measures can be taken by the United States and its allies. So I don't see any change in the U.S. position here.
Okay, no change in the position, but is South Korea getting ahead of the game?
I don't know. I think this is just a signal that Mike Pompeo is putting out there to let the South Koreans know that this is still the position that the United States has, and it's the position that the U.S. will maintain, and that South Korea is on notice for that.
Apparently, in a meeting last month, the South Korean foreign minister said Pompeo expressed discontent at an inter-Korean military pact reached during a summit in September. Is that accurate?
I believe Minister Gang that's the South Korean foreign minister, has confirmed that this is to be true, yes.
What do you think of the pace of denuclearization?
all indications suggest that North Korea is not moving in a meaningful way on that front. And this is why the talks are stalling, and South Korea is pushing for more concessions from the United States in order to break the impasse. But it's not clear to me why U.S. needs to be the one that breaks its principled position on this and not North Korea, since North Korea hasn't had any principled position on this. I believe that they are in agreement on this. The U.S. has made this position very clear for both North and South Korea. It's not clear to me why the U.S. needs to make that first concession here.
What is the pace of the Korean rapprochement?
Clearly, it's been going in a very slow but yet steady pace. Despite the sort of U.S. and the North Korean talks stalling, the North and South Koreans have had three summits already. They've had many working-level talks. And there have been some meaningful steps. There's an office that's opened in Kaesong. They've demined some areas of the DMZ, and the South Koreans are moving ahead as firmly as they can without violating the sanctions to sort of warm up the mood between the South and North Korea.
Is it your view that North Korea is stalling?
I believe North Korea is not being forthcoming about its intention when it comes to denuclearizing. If they were serious, then some of these demands that the U.S. have been making, at least in part or not as a whole, they should be making those concessions. And I don't think the U.S., there's no reason to believe here why U.S. will not follow through on other fronts as they've already promised.
As for a second U.S.-North Korea summit, James Kim says he sees it as a 50-50 prospect of such a meeting in the new year, but it must be preceded by what he calls a clear plan with a clear strategy at the working level. Otherwise, he sees a repeat of the June meeting, little progress toward the ultimate goal of denuclearization. Happening now in Asia, Afghanistan observed a national day of mourning Wednesday, a day after dozens of people died in a terror attack in the Afghan capital of Kabul. The suicide bomber blew himself up Tuesday in a banqueting hall where Islamic religious scholars had gathered in the Afghan capital, killing more than 50 people. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. In Pakistan, where 25 million children are not in school, thousands of ghost schools are making matters worse. These are schools that either exist on paper only, have a building that's being used for another purpose, or being left to dilapidate. Aisha Tanzim has this report.
The blackboard still has scribblings from years ago, but the room no longer looks like a classroom. Children and their parents wonder if this building will ever be used for its original purpose.
We are tired of spending money to make trips to local officials. The school opened for 2 days in 2016 and then closed again. We've been trying since 2006 to open the school, but no one listens to us.
This is a perfect example of what's known in the entire region as ghost schools. A building is dedicated by the government for a school, funds are allocated every month for repair and maintenance, and teachers are paid salaries to come and teach the children of all the surrounding villages. And yet, no one comes here to teach, and no one looks after the building. These are officially called non-functional schools. Most end up this way as a result of either neglect or corruption. Activists and NGOs say the money allocated for such schools often ends up in the coffers of bureaucrats, politicians, or local school staff. Last year's education statistics of Pakistan revealed that several thousand of them still exist, even after various provincial governments have been trying to correct the issue. The majority of these non-functional schools are in Sindh and Balochistan provinces. Many are in areas where people live in abject poverty and parents are desperate to give their kids a better life.
I take care of my land and animals in the village. We want our children to go to school. We are unemployed. If the children get an education, they can go to the city and get jobs.
While there is broad consensus on the problem across the political spectrum in Pakistan, the actions needed to fix it seem slow in coming. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
As we continue, a conclusion to World War II may be finally in sight if Vladimir Putin gets his way. This is VOA Asia.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The United States and China clashed Wednesday at a World Trade Organization meeting, with a U.S. envoy accusing Beijing of using the WTO to pursue non-market policies, and a Chinese official saying it was Washington that was flouting the rule book. President Trump has outraged U.S. trading partners by erecting a tariff wall against imports of steel and aluminum. This is VOA Asia. Europe this month marked the 100th anniversary of the armistice that brought World War I to an end. Now a conclusion to World War II may be finally in sight if Russian President Vladimir Putin gets his way. The Russian leader has an initiative to sign a final peace treaty with Japan and resolve a Soviet-era dispute over the fate of several small islands in Russia's Far East. Charles Maines traveled to that region. He has this report.
To visit the island of Sakhalin is to be reminded of the shifting fortunes of empire. From Imperial Japan to Tsarist Russia and later Soviet rule, wars and changing boundaries have shaped Sakhalin's history, carrying families in their wake.
I was born here, grew up here. Until I was 7, I was brought up in a Japanese family.
Sirakata's parents stayed in Sakhalin after Soviet forces took control of the island in the waning days of World War II, so young Masayoshi adapted, learning Russian and later joining the Soviet army to guard against the Japanese.
The Japanese are coming from over there, they'd say during attack drills. What do you mean, coming? Here's one right next to me. We all joked about it.
Today, locals prefer to tout Sakhalin's growing economic integration with Asia. While the Kremlin has invested heavily in the island, Sakhalin's oil, gas, fishing, and tourism industries are all banking on outside investment and visitors. It's a long way from days when the Soviet territory was closed to outsiders.
We were part of the Soviet Union. We were developing the cities and factories. The people came here to live and work. When I was a schoolboy, I was not at all interested if we had some relations with Japan or not.
But Sakhalin's Korean community, still vibrant, has never forgotten.
My family history is tragic, but that tragedy touched not only us. Take almost any family here and it's the same.
Brought to Sakhalin as cheap labor by the Japanese, the island's Korean diaspora was cut off from their homeland as the Iron Curtain descended. Even today, the process of family reunification and unfulfilled demands for Japanese reparations is an open wound for many.
My home is Sakhalin, but my roots are in Korea. And if we forget our roots, we forget who we are.
Differences over whose roots also lie at the heart of a dispute over the tiny Kuril Islands that has kept Russia and Japan formally at war for over 70 years. Russian President Vladimir Putin has suggested to Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe the two sides work out a deal by year's end. How realistic that goal, say some locals, depends on how willing the Japanese are to bend.
Russia, of course, is a generous country and ready to forgive old debts. But give away its territory? No one will forgive that.
And with Russia facing another territorial dispute over the annexation of Crimea, the long standoff with Japan may offer a lesson that resolutions to some disputes remain out of reach, somewhere beyond the horizon. Charles Maines for VOA News, Sakhalin Island, Russia.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Tens of thousands of workers launched a half-day strike across South Korea Wednesday, accusing the government of rolling back pro-labor policies in the face of deepening economic woes. Union groups say some 40,000 of those who put down tools, including some of the auto industry, rallied in Seoul and 13 other cities. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. Today is Thanksgiving in the United States, along with several other countries around the globe. The holiday commemorates as a harvest festival celebrated by the pilgrims in 1621 and is held in the U.S. on the fourth Thursday in November. It's marked by family gatherings featuring a traditional meal, usually involving turkey with all the trimmings. But it's not possible for all families to be at one place at the same time. Through its nonprofit's annual Holiday Meals for Military program, Operation Homefront distributes Thanksgiving meals to military families in the Washington, D.C. area every year. They've given away hundreds of thousands of meals since the program started. VOA's Mariama Diallo was there as this year's families received their holiday meals.
400 boxes filled with goodies to help celebrate this year's Thanksgiving holiday.
Happy Thanksgiving!
Vivian Dittrich is a senior director for Operation Homefront's Mid-Atlantic region.
We're celebrating this giving of thanks here at Thanksgiving by providing a holiday meal to our military families, and each family is getting a fully prepared Thanksgiving dinner from Harris Teeter, MillerCoors, and Jackson Family Wine. They're working together to help us sponsor this meal.
In the boxes, some cranberry sauce, mashed potatoes, green bean casserole, and more to go with the traditional turkey meal. But more than just food, it's an opportunity for families to spend some quality time together, says Brigadier General Aaron Dean II of the D.C. National Guard.
Thanksgiving baskets represent the opportunity for you to bring your families closer together, a chance for you to get with your family and share a meal, conversation, camaraderie, and the sense of family and the sense of belonging in that day we call Thanksgiving.
His wife, Laura Dean, says although she doesn't wear the uniform, as a military spouse, she's thankful for what her husband and others have given up over the years.
They give their lives, they sacrifice a lot for us. And when they do that, they're sacrificing several things with their families. They miss birthdays, they miss holidays, they miss promotions. They miss a lot of things with their own families just so that they can give the citizens of this country the freedoms.
Sergeant Jonathan Hune has been serving in the military for 16 years. He attended with his daughter.
We're real grateful for everything that happens when stuff like this happens for us because it's hard on families. It's hard being away from our families and just knowing that we have all the support behind us here, just in our communities and everywhere. Supporting the military is a great honor.
Specialist Daniel Jones brought his four sons with him.
I'm thankful to everyone who acknowledges, and my children are grateful as well because they get to see that there are people that care.
But as for who's going to help Daddy in the kitchen on Thanksgiving Day,
I'm going to let him cook it on his own. I'm going to just eat it all.
I want to help my dad make the macaroni and cheese.
I'll try to help my dad.
I wouldn't help because my dad doesn't like that many people in the kitchen because that's how he gets it done faster.
Safety first. I show him some things, but I try to keep the kitchen clear.
In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study from a pair of geophysicists proposes our current ice age, which began between 2.6 and 3.2 million years ago, may have been caused by a true polar wander, or a shift in the geological location of the Earth's poles. It's thought that this phenomenon could be caused when dense lumps of the Earth's mantle builds up in areas far from the equator. The study from researchers at Rice University in Texas suggests over the past 12 million years, this true polar wander has caused Greenland to move close enough to the North Pole to kick off what some call the Quaternary Ice Age. To reach their findings, the scientists analyzed fossil signatures in deep ocean sediment samples, the magnetic signature of oceanic crust, as well as the position of the mantle hotspot that created what are now the Hawaiian Islands. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com. Our thanks to our Director Tracy Carter, our engineer John Ellison, Managing Director Diane Gao, and our team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.